Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I am a former middle school teacher. I'm a current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so that's what we explore on this podcast. I share ideas and blueprints. I tell stories and give some practical strategies. I interview experts. I share some of my big, epic mistakes that I've made and continue to make along the way, all because I know that teachers are such a critical component to helping students reach their creative potential. And before we get started, I just want to share a word from our sponsor, which is McGraw-Hill. Teachers, listen up. If you're looking to lift up your students in a new way, then you've got to check out the Redbird Adaptive Math and ELA program. Redbird bundles from McGraw-Hill are as little as $40 for the year for grades 3-8. The Redbird curriculum features the latest in adaptive instruction, gamification, and digital project-based learning to meet both national and state standards. Accelerate your students' learning with something different and fun. Check out Redbird today. Go to mheonline.com/redbird1 and get $5 off of your classroom bundle. Again, that's go to mheonline.com/redbird1 and get $5 off of your classroom bundle. That's MHE for McGraw-Hill Education, online.com/redbird1. Remember, Redbird bundles are as little as $40 for the year. Check out Redbird today at mheonline/redbird1 and get $5 off of your classroom bundle. Again, that's MHE for McGraw-Hill Education, online.com/redbird1. Today, I interview Manuel Herrera, and a little bit about Manuel Herrera. He is an educator, a speaker, and an illustrator. He specializes in sketchnoting, visual thinking, which is what most of this conversation is going to be about, design thinking, and creative problem solving. Over the past 18 years, he has keynoted and led workshops at educational conferences like South by Southwest EDU, ISTE, TCEA, MassQ, FETC, and .edu. Manuel has illustrated books, publications, and graphics for a variety of organizations, publishers, and schools. Currently, he is the coordinator of learning services for the Afton School District, and he's an adjunct professor for Webster University, both located in St. Louis, Missouri. In 2018, Manuel became a Google Innovator at LAX18, and in 2016, he was named Midwest Education Technology Conference Spotlight Educator. You can follow Manuel on Twitter and on Instagram at Manuel Herrera 33. One of the things that I'll say about him is I love his illustration style. I love his sketching. If you ever see my work, you know that I love to draw. I love to include my drawings in what I do. But I'm just struck by how bold he is, how creative he is, how he has, you know, just found this visual creative voice, which I'm really intrigued by. And I just love his work. I think it looks really, really cool. And I think it's practical, too, for classroom teachers. So that's what this episode is all about. All right, we got Manuel here. And one of my thoughts as we begin this interview is, we ran into each other a few different times at conferences. I got a chance to see you in a session before, and that was a blast. The energy that you brought to it, the creativity that you brought, but also just that practical reality of, you know, the classroom experience. And I kind of think of you as an educator and an illustrator. And I'm curious how you got into the illustration side of things.
So, you know, it was an interesting thing that I really never thought would happen. So, I guess, as an educator, when I taught, one of the things that I would always do with my kids. So taught middle school math, and then I also taught special ed. So I taught eighth grade tax prep. Tax was our state test. So I taught that to our students. You know, I got all the kids who like struggled in math, got all those kids. And then I also taught special ed. And so these two groups of kids were always kids who had trouble understanding content. And for me, I was a kid who struggled with that as well. But what helped me was to draw things out. And so when I would explain and work with kids, I would just draw things just naturally. That's just how I express, how I explain and describe. And it kind of started with that and continued to do it all the way up until about, I don't know, 7-8 years ago, where fast forward, I was working with students in a design class, or not a design class, but in a design space, where I'd have these kids that would come in and to work on projects, and they would, a lot of these projects were design oriented. And so I'd, you know, break out markers and pens and kind of start to draw them to explain things to them. And I realized like, okay, this still helps. Like kids are still into this. Kids still better understand things. And so it was kind of from that that I realized like, okay, this is valuable to kids. This is working. This makes sense. Kind of share this with teachers. And teachers are like, yeah, this is great. Like, how do you do this? What are you doing? And kind of just explaining. And then social media happened. And I started to just publish some of that stuff. Like I would just post it like, hey, it worked with the kids. And we were designing 3D print. Here's some sketches that I did. Here's some sketches they did. And it was kind of just the constant, you know, publishing of those that people started to notice drawing. They just started to notice my drawings. And for me, it was just something I did as a way to explain. And for others, it was like, wow, that's art. That looks great. I'm into that. Can you draw? And then like requests, like, can you draw this? Can you draw that? And it kind of just snowballed from there, man. It really was an accidental thing based on something I had always done. And, you know, I definitely would say, you know, I definitely say social media played a huge role into it. And so then eventually I got, you know, kind of some courage to post just drawings I would do for fun. You know, I'd always drawn as a kid, you know, for both explaining and understanding, but also to just as a form of expression. And I finally started to post personal drawings. Like here's a drawing of, you know, whatever it might've been. And you know, the likes go up and your confidence kind of boosts and you continue to post that. And then I would get requests. I would get requests to, you know, hey, can you illustrate this? Can you draw this? Can you do a graphic for that? I started working with a nonprofit here in St. Louis called Connected Learning. And you know, we would host educational events across St. Louis and across, kind of the St. Louis area. And my role was just kind of a support. So I would host sessions or facilitate sessions, but I started to notice like the graphics and things that we were putting out to advertise some of our events were not that great. And so I went to kind of the founder and said, hey, do you mind, can I give this a shot? Can I start to, you know, create some of the graphics that we do for some of our events? He's like, sure. He's like, I just, you know, do with them in Keynote. He's like, whatever you want to do. And so then I started to explore a little bit into Photoshop and Illustrator. I started to play around with that a little bit and started to create graphics for our events. And again, like people were like, wow, that looks great. And a lot of them were pretty basic graphics, but I always looked forward to doing our EdCamp one. So EdCamp was the big event that we did every year. And I try to remain consistent with all of our other events that we did throughout the year. So it was kind of a standard look to them. Occasionally I would get to play a little bit with some of the visuals, but EdCamp I look forward to because EdCamp I kind of had free range. Like, what's our theme? Our theme is, you know, space. I'm like, awesome. Like I'm going to get into this. And so I really had a chance to kind of express myself to a bigger audience and people who would actually look at it. And, you know, I got kudos and like, that's great. And can we put that into a t-shirt? And I'm like, wow, really? You want this on a t-shirt? And it kind of, it kept going from there. And so from those graphics to my own illustrations, I got asked to do, you know, a set of icons, which again, I didn't have any experience doing other than what I did on my own. So I have to go research. I'd go look up like, icon sets. Like, how does that work? Like, there has to be consistency in that. How do you design those? How do you think through those? So that's really how I got into illustration. It was not anything intentional by any means. It really started off as kind of an accident.
We'll get into the education part in a moment. I want to stick in the illustration part for just a little bit longer. And what I'm curious about is, at what point did you define yourself as an illustrator?
I think, oh man, this was, you know, I still deal with imposter syndrome quite a bit. Yeah. You know, I started to listen to podcasts on design and podcasts on illustration, and it got into my head a little bit. You know, instead of like listening to that and valuing myself, I started listening to that and been like, I don't have this training, I don't have this background, I don't have these you know whatever I would need in my, whatever it was in my head to become an illustrator, or to say that I was an illustrator. But it also, mm-hmm. it also helped push me to realize, like, okay, this is what everybody experiences. Like, everybody experiences imposter syndrome, mm-hmm. in some sense, in any industry, in any mm-hmm. field. And I think what mm-hmm. made me feel better about saying that I was an illustrator was when I actually put together or illustrated my first kid's book. Like, when that kind of happened, something about that mm-hmm. was the stamp of like, yes, you can say you're an illustrator. And that was only last year. And so I've probably been, you know, illustrating, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. You know, it wasn't until then, last year, that, you know, I could say, okay, cool, I can say I'm an illustrator. Like, I've done enough work that I have mm-hmm. this like portfolio of stuff that I can say, if somebody says, oh, you're an illustrator, let me see your work. And I can say, here's enough content mm-hmm. that's been in a book, in a magazine, in a publication, on a website, on a, you know, a brochure, or not a brochure, but on a, like a conference, something for a conference. It was when I had enough of that stuff that I was like, okay, I'm getting close. And then when I said I had a book, I was like, all right, that's it. Like, okay, I can say I'm already saying I'm an illustrator. I'm an illustrator. Like, I can say that now.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was always like, I felt like I had to have these credentials of some sort. And nobody put that in my head but me. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's kind of how I finally developed a sense of like, I can say that I'm an illustrator. I don't know why. I don't know what it was that kept me from doing that for so long. But it's kind of cool.
If you were to guess, what would it be that kept you from
you know,
doing that for so long?
I think talking to different people who were in that industry, hearing conversations about, you know, just because, and this was a real conversation or a side conversation I heard, it's from a couple of designers that said, oh, anybody who has Photoshop feels like they're a designer. And I was like, wow, okay, that's a real thought from somebody like, that they have Photoshop and Illustrator, that they're a real designer. And so I think that kind of stuck in my head a little bit. And so that kind of prevented me from, not prevent, well, yeah, it kept me from thinking that, yeah, I can, I'm an illustrator. I felt like I had to achieve something in order to say that. Like, it wasn't a degree, it was just some sort of recognition in some way, whether it was, you know, you've got this graphic or this illustration and is now on this website. I needed that brand. I needed that badge. I needed that kind of, somebody else saying besides my mom,
like that external validation.
Yeah. Like an external validation. Yeah. Like, it's one thing to have your mom say, yeah, your drawings are great, but it's another to have somebody who is no tie to me whatsoever and say, yeah, this guy is here. They're proud to say that I did it. You know, I don't know. I think that's what I needed. You know, I didn't have that. I didn't know what that was like. It was just a skill that I practiced, but I had no one to show it to validate it. There was no validation up to that point. I was just doing it and doing it and doing it and doing it. You know, I will say something else that kind of trickled into my head that like maybe I should try this a little hard, you know, maybe put some effort into it, was, and you know, you and I had talked a little bit before, but was Rebecca Hare. She's a designer and an art teacher. And man, this was probably 7 years ago. She saw some of my drawings and said, these are really good. Like, have you thought about trying to do this more? And I was like, wow, okay, so here's somebody who is a designer, who does do illustrations, who does do artwork, who does have those credentials recognizing my work. So like that kind of boosted me a little bit. Like that was like, okay. And that was around the time where I started to put things online and publish things online, because that gave me a little vote of confidence to do that. But mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I think I've always felt like I had no connection to the art world, so I didn't know how everybody else did it. And all I understood was that you go to college, you get a degree, you get, you know, and then you start to create work and you develop a portfolio. I didn't do any of that. So I felt like I had to have that in order to say I was anything. Otherwise, anybody who has Photoshop, Illustrator, or picks up a pen can say they're an illustrator. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, that kind of mindset, it stuck. It stuck in my head for a while. And I'm still waiting for like just a like from one, you know, from those two guys. You know, like I just want them to, you know, it's like that kind of, that stuff like sticks. I mean, it'll, you know, it down the road. But yeah, it's those little things that that stuck with me. So
last question about the sort of illustration design side. One of the things you mentioned was consistency, and it feels like you reached a point where you have a consistent style, right? You have this style that's distinctly yours. Call it, you know, your voice, your style, whatever it may be. What was that process like? And would you say it was more defining your style or discovering your style?
Oof. You know, I I'd have to say it was definitely discovering my style, because, you know, I could go back and look, and I've got, you know, tons of journals of different artwork that I've done and different things that I've worked on. You know, I think part of it was discovery. I knew I liked to draw. I had some, you know, things that I could draw well that I would draw over and over again. But I started to kind of, the more I started to explore drawing and illustration, and then starting to look for influences outside of what I had when I was a kid, you know, I started to copy them. I started to very much emulate what they were doing until I could mix that with my style, with what I was comfortable with how I held the pen, with how I moved, you know, a marker or a stylus or a pencil. It was all kind of, it was just this constant journey. I really had no end in mind. It was just kind of constantly like trying to blend what I saw and what I could do over and over and over and over again, that eventually like I landed on something that I'm like, okay, I'm consistently drawing like this, like over and over, like whether it was a sketch note, whether it was an illustration, whether it was, just, you know, doodling, I started to realize like, all right, I feel comfortable in this space. I feel comfortable making these kind of strokes. It was definitely a discovery. It was definitely like, I'd never thought about it so hard. And I don't even know if it was, maybe it wasn't, I was thinking about it so hard, but it just became a subconscious, and eventually it just became a subconscious style. Like, and that's when I kind of knew I landed on it. And I've caught myself trying to add more and trying to change that style just to give myself kind of a spectrum of styles. But I always go back to this kind of same style that I'm comfortable with, that I enjoy, that I like, that people seem to enjoy and people seem to like and people seem to comment on. It was an ongoing.
I think that's an interesting piece.
No, that was it.
Yeah. I think there's an interesting piece that you bring up, which is, you know, there is this element of self-discovery when it comes to creative work and finding your creative voice. But then there's the secondary element of external validation still matters, right? Like like you have to have people outside of you, you know, outside of yourself in your own head, who validate and affirm your creative work. And that's a part of what boosts creative confidence. Mm-hmm. And just seems like, you know, it's not always internal. It's kind of presented as internal, but actually, like, we need validation and affirmation.
We do. And what I've learned is that how wide that is shouldn't matter. At some point it became like, somebody's validating me. I'm not going to make everybody happy. And that was kind of a journey in myself. Like, the art that I create, the illustrations that I make, the designs that I do are only going to appeal to certain people. And for, as I was learning my style, as I was, and I still tinker with it, I'm still trying to fit this like really large audience, when really I'm like, no. Like, I need to be okay with where I am. Like, I need to be okay with the 20 people who like it, as opposed to like trying to please 100 people. And so that's also a journey. Like, that's, you got to be okay with that. Like, you got to realize, I'm not going to please everybody, and that's okay. And I'm going to have a niche, or I'm going to have a target of people that enjoy this, but I want validation from those people. Like, you know, I want to make stuff for those people. Like, I think it was like the breadth of that. Like, I need to be okay with it being smaller, and I'm okay with it. Like, it took me a little while to get to that. It took me a little while to say, like, you know what, John's not going to like all my illustrations, but these other 10 people.
I do that. So that's the wrong person.
But I'm just saying, like, you know, like having
a person liking all the Instagram posts.
Like, it, just realizing, like, I didn't have to please everybody. And that was, you know, that was, you know, like, oh man, I posted that. It's such a, you know, I posted that and 20 people liked it, and, you know, I posted that, but 100 people liked it. And that plays with your head a little bit too. Like, social media, like, definitely, it validates you and it encourages you and it motivates you, but it also like can discourage you. It can also like, you know, play tricks on you.
And, oh yeah.
You know, I think you'd be lying if it didn't, you know, if you said it didn't. But I finally came to a place where I'm like, okay, cool. Like, this is my style. Like, I've reached it. I've kind of found it. It's okay to like tinker here and there just to, you know, have fun. But, and we had talked about this earlier, like, people hire you or people ask you to do things because they like your style that you present 90% of the time. And that's what they want. Mm-hmm. They want that style. Like, you know, if you want to, you know, I found myself going down rabbit holes of like trying to learn, like, oh, I want to do like that guy or that girl or these people. Like, I want to, like, no, man, the people hired me to do this. Like, they want me to do my style. So it's a fine line, man. It's a fine line you got to walk. And with social media, but it's, you know, it still plays in your head a little bit. So.
Oh, for sure. I'm curious, you know, so you're an educator and an illustrator. You've been doing a lot of illustration on the side. But for people who aren't going to ever define themselves as illustrators, for people who say, look, I'm not very artistic, I don't like to draw, it's, you know, I wasn't the kid who was drawing all the time. For someone like that, what would you say is the benefit of drawing or sketching for two different areas, for the creative process and for the learning process?
You know, I think they kind of go both hand in hand. So for somebody who's going to draw and not for an artistic value, you know, Dan Rome was a visual practitioner who wrote a book, who wrote a couple of books, but the book he wrote called Draw to Win. In that book, he says, you know, drawing is, stop thinking about drawing as an artistic process. Think about drawing as a thinking process. And like that mm-hmm. just really hit. Because when I work with teachers, I'm not working with teachers on teaching them how to be a great artist. I'm teaching them how to use drawing to think. Because while I did them simultaneously, as I worked with kids, I realized like just taking abstract concepts and simplifying them with like stick figures and shapes meant the impacted them so much more. And so, you know, if you use drawing as a thinking process, you're just trying to organize information. You're not trying to make it beautiful. You're not trying to make it pretty. You're not trying to make it presentable. You're just trying to organize complex information or abstract information into a way that makes logical sense to you. You know, I do a couple activities in which I get people to draw simple things very, very quickly. And that's how I want them to see drawing. Like, I'm just drawing this really quickly. It's a scribble. That scribble now looks like a bird. Great. We can all agree that's a bird. It's not the best bird, but it's a bird. And we can move on and we can continue talking about a flock or a migration or food. A food chain or whatever it might be. That's what I want people to capture. Like, I'm just trying to organize information. The other side is being creative, is it's taking that same information, but like working through it. You know, I'm working right now on a design thinking presentation for elementary kids. And in working with elementary kids over the past few years, words are hard sometimes for young kids. Writing words, reading words can take a long time for a lot of kids. But we can draw simple pictures and explain things. They can do the same thing. They can draw simple pictures to explain very difficult concepts that they're trying to work through. So for them, they can kind of draw those simple things, iterate those, change those, make adjustments, whether it's an eraser or just a markout or by adding more imagery on top of it. That helps them understand what it is you're trying to teach them or what it is they're trying to learn. They become a little more creative with that because we're not taking the time to like build something. We're not trying to take time to like explain a piece of software. We're not trying to explain how to use a piece of technology. We're just using paper and pencil or marker and a desktop or a desk and drawing those out. Like, it just makes things so much easier for kids, using things that's almost innate, I guess. You know, as soon as we can pick something up and start to make marks, you know, we're trying to explain things, we're trying to describe things. So I was kind of all over on that answer. I'm not sure if I captured it just right, but creativity and thinking process sometimes for me goes hand in hand. I'm trying to think through a problem. Yeah. I'm going to use simple drawings. I want to be creative. So I want to take that problem or that solution I might have drawn and iterate it using more simple drawings and more ideas. I'm also communicating that to someone I might be working with. So if I'm a student in a group and I'm trying to explain to people, like, we can all look at that and say, you drew that. That's what you mean. This is what you're saying. You're saying if we create whatever it is, you're saying to put it right there, to move it over here, to edit it here. Like, we can all see what that is. Sometimes with kids, we talk at them and words just kind of linger in the air, you know? And so having that concrete example helps so much. You know, I've got numerous stories where kids come to work on projects together with a 3D printer and none of them have any idea what they want to create. And so when you can draw it out for them as they describe it to you, they're like, oh, yeah. And like the whole group is like, oh, yeah, that's what we're trying to make. But something as simple as that we were not doing with kids. We at least in my experience, weren't doing with kids.
So one of the things that I find fascinating is, you know, I've done an activity with kindergartners and graduate students, right? So I'm now at the university level teaching pre-service teachers. And so I will sometimes ask a question and then I tell them to answer the question by sketching it out using no words. You can use symbols, you can use arrows, you can make it one single drawing, but you cannot use words. And, you know, kindergartners might draw a single picture, but often they'll have multiple pictures. Sometimes they'll have the arrows going back and forth. They run with it. The pre-service teachers are much more likely to be really reticent, really worried, ask if they can do it later, ask, you know, no, it's our warm up. You got 6 minutes to do it. Let's go. And I will hear something from the teachers that I never hear from the kindergartners, which is, I'm not good at drawing, or I'm not an artist, right? And so what do you think happens that people get to that place where they say, this isn't who I am? Because it's more than I'm good or bad at it. It becomes literally, I'm not an artist, or I'm not, it goes beyond just skill level into like, this isn't what I do. So what do you think happens in the K-12 experience that then leads to college students who would say something like, I'm not an artist, why am I drawing? You know?
I've been asked this question and several different times. I think it's, as adults who work with students, we have this perception somewhere along the line, like we were told drawing is an artistic process. Drawing is art. Like, there is somebody who's going to critique it, somebody who's going to say it's good or bad. And we like push these fears on our students, fears or anxiety, or just the verbiage of, you don't have to be a good artist, or something about quantifying what they're drawing in some way, or qualifying that. Like we do that to students somewhere along the way, rather than using it as a tool to express ideas or express thought. Mm-hmm. I think that happens. Like, you know, that's just the nature of education. Like, we're going to work with, you know, people with different backgrounds, people with different experiences growing up, and they're going to present those to the students in some way. And I think that happens somewhere, and that seed gets planted of, when I make marks on a paper, there's good and bad. And it may start with handwriting. I don't know. Like, handwriting could also be like, well, you didn't make your S. Okay, well, that stroke isn't just right. And so like that right and wrong at some point of putting a pencil to paper affects your mind when you do it again. And whether it's your handwriting, because we can all think of that kid that had the sloppy handwriting. Like, I'm even doing it. Like, the sloppy handwriting, the not so legible handwriting. And we make those comments. So you associate the pen, the marker, to paper, to making marks as good and bad, or not quality work. And so anytime you do that, you have this sense of like, I can't do it. Like, it's not as good. You're going to judge me. So I don't know if it's how much of it's drawing and how much of it's just things that we do in general that we can say are good and bad. But somewhere along that way, like, we impose those on kids. I when I work with teachers and we talk about introducing, you know, drawing as a thinking process, like, how do you do that? What do you draw? What do you say? And I said, well, when I taught, kids are really good. When I was teaching middle school, you know, this was pre, you know, one-to-one, this is pre Chromebooks, pre technology in the classroom. Kids are really good at taking notes, right? They're really good at, like, this was like in the day of like writing notes out on an overhead, or writing notes on a chalkboard or a dry erase. Kids are really good about copying that. Like, they would copy. So what I would do, and would just be subconsciously, is as I was explaining things, I would just draw these things out. And the kids are really good about drawing exactly what I drew. I didn't stand up there and say, hey guys, don't worry, I'm not a good artist. And I would just like draw. Okay, we're going to talk about the branches of government. So the executive branch, and here is, you know, the White House, and then we have the judicial branch, and here's the Supreme Court. And then we have, you know, legislative branch, and here's what Congress looks like. I would just draw those, and the kids would do the same. And that was it. Like, nobody said that. I didn't say, this is not a good drawing. You know, I didn't get caught up in that. And so you'd go and look at the kids' papers. They drew exactly what you drew. And that was it. Like, that was, so yeah. Somewhere we put those seeds in students' heads. Like, we put those seeds in their heads. Like, this isn't good. This isn't, but it's not about being good. I'm trying to explain something. I'm just trying to show you, you know, a graphic organizer of some sort. It doesn't have to be perfect. That's not the point. This is,
yeah.
You know, so I think we put that.
I always tell people, like, I mean, I don't know if this helps, but I say, like, that when it comes to sketching out your ideas, making thinking visible in any way, whether we're doing a concept map or if you're doing a sketch note while you're watching a video or listening to a podcast, or if you're doing, you know, whatever it may be, sketching out something for a prototype, I always say, like, this isn't art, right? But also, like, the level of quality I'm looking for is like right at Pictionary, right? In other words, if you ever played Pictionary as a kid, like, it's like a successful drawing is simply, can someone else understand what it is? And if the answer is yes, that's a pretty low threshold. Like, that's all it has to be, right? And I think that adults in particular tend to underestimate how good they are at drawing. Like, they tend to really believe that they are awful at sketching, and they're not. And they in the exact same way that they tend to overestimate how good they are at driving a car, right? Like I always want to be like, you are not as good of a driver as you think you are, and you are not as bad of a sketcher or a drawer or whatever. And so some of it is just it's like getting them to see, okay, actually, the quality level just has to be, like, legible in the same way that we would with handwriting. Mm-hmm. And once that threshold is low, what I found is that actually a lot of people will learn how to draw faster, but also, like, their quality goes up, oddly enough. Like, once the fear is gone, like, their actual quality tends to be pretty good. And so that's just an observation I have. I would love to hear, you know, you talk about sketching, drawing as a thinking process rather than an artistic process. What are some very specific strategies that teachers can use to have students making their thinking visible with drawing or sketching? Give me some practical areas where a teacher might want to integrate that into their lessons.
You know, one of the things that, you know, I show teachers, because it's something that we just do with kids at a young age, but we stop doing it as they get older, mm-hmm. or something as simple as using graphic organizers, you know, stuff like that, just mm-hmm. taking concepts and mm-hmm. organizing them in some way. I am not a fan of pre-drawn graphic organizers. I mean, I get them, I understand them. But sometimes, like, I feel like for younger kids, they draw so big and they write so big that when you make an 8.5 by 11 with little circles and you're asking kids to draw inside of them, you know, that's tough. So I like to, things that we can do with kids is, you know, drawing stories. So one of the things we did with the second graders, as we were having kids, they were reading Frog and Toad books, and they were going to compare emotions of Frog and Toad at different events in a story. And we just took a piece of paper, we folded it in half, and it basically made a T-chart. On one side is Frog, one side is emotion. And as we read this book, we asked kids to, okay, use emojis, you know, draw emojis to represent emotions at certain points in the book. And so there would be kind of this, you know, Frog was happy, Frog was sad, Frog was worried, and Toad was whatever. And we kind of just, you know, at the same moments within the book. And we did that. And it was a way for them to go back and recall, like, okay, so when they were in the meadow, what were the animals feeling? So they could go back and look at these notes, kind of like early sketch notes, right? And what was cool is that this one student, he took it to another level, and I don't know why we didn't think of this. He drew the settings in the middle, down the seam of the fold. And he drew the picture of the meadow. He drew the picture of the forest. He drew the picture of the house. And he used that to organize, like, so when we asked, he knew exactly where to go on his little chart. And so little things like graphic organizers help kids so much with information. You know, mind mapping is something that's easy, that's easily done with students. And when I say drawing, I don't always mean like an actual picture. When I say drawing, I mean, it can be like the circles as you've done this on a graphic organizer, and then some of the words and maybe some small shapes inside of it. That's still drawing. I mean, writing is drawing. Using graphic organizers with kids is amazing. Story maps as kids read stories. I had an AP Lit class at our high school. They drew The Great Gatsby as they read it, and it was very stick figure-y, labeled, Nick Carraway and, Tom Buchanan, literally underneath. I think eventually he used initials, but they were just stick figures. Tom Buchanan had like little bumps on his arm so that you knew he was like this muscle bound guy with Yale on the shirt, little things like that. And they knew like, okay, but they had this relationship with this person over here. So you drew that stick figure and you drew the line. And in the end, it looked like a hot mess, right? Like, I mean, it was just all over the place. But if you were the students in that class as you read, and you were there with Tom Buchanan, you were there with Nick Carraway, and it kind of grew and grew and grew. And in your mind, it's kind of like a stop motion picture that occurs, that eventually happens. Though that was huge. And that was student driven. The students asked, three students in the class asked if they could do that, because they were having a hard time kind of keeping up with the book and understanding the stories, and whatever was just the kids was driven by them. And the teacher said it was interesting because when everything was said and done, the sketch note had been erased or the sketch had been erased and they were still having discussions, the kids would point at this blank board at where those events happened and occurred, because there's a connection between where you drew, where you drew it and how it made sense to you and what event happened, and all the details are associated with the upper left-hand corner of the board, or those kind of things help. I mean, there's research that shows with memory alone, how drawing can help with memory. And the research that's there, it's more so in focusing, but little things like that, things that we've always done. It's not asking teachers to go and learn how to draw anything. It's kind of using what we've always done in schools and continuing to use those practices as kids get older, so that kids eventually, like, as they take notes or as they work through things, that becomes just as a part of their tool set as, like, we cram Cornell notes down kids' throats, at least at one time. I don't know if we still do that, but
I always. I mean, it's interesting when you bring up the research, because there is a research on the focus component. There's also been some research on just the retention of knowledge, and the assumption is that it has to do with the focus, right? That if you're more focused, for example, handwritten notes versus non-handwritten notes, but then, or typed notes, but then also sketched out notes versus handwritten notes, right? And one of the key ideas is that it's partly due to focus. The other piece is that the retention of knowledge that happens might be because of the fact that the process is mirroring the synaptic connections that are forming, right? So, and nobody knows this completely. It's kind of emerging research, but it's interesting to see how the idea might be that part of what's going on is, as you sketch things out or draw them out, it tends to be nonlinear, and your mind is nonlinear, right? I mean, that's right. A part of it too. And I think an aspect of it, which hasn't really been explored in the research, but I think a part of it is the fact that when you draw something, whether it is a flowchart that you're drawing or a symbol that you're drawing or an actual sketch of something happening, you are building a bridge between the abstract and the concrete. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's actually really critical, because I think that's a huge part of conceptual understanding. So I think all of these factors are at work, which is why a high school math class needs drawing, an AP calculus class needs a drawing as much as a kindergarten literature class.
For sure. I mean, that's exactly why you don't explain anything in an upper level math class without having some kind of drawing to represent it. Right. Like, so why would, yeah, I don't know. That's one activity that you could do. Something else that I do with kids, and this kind of goes along the lines of, like, we're not linear thinkers, is planning presentations, like when kids plan out presentations or videos or anything like that. It drives me crazy. You know, we don't help kids with planning out presentations. And I say, when I say we, I mean, like in my experience and what I've done with students and how I've seen teachers work with students. You know, we started to introduce using like note cards with kids and sticky notes. But more so to like, as you're doing research, you know, or as you're planning things out, to draw things out or write things out in these cards, and then to go back and organize that later, rather than like get so focused on like, I have a PowerPoint presentation that slides 1 through 10 and trying to fill them out as I go. I can have all these ideas and all this thinking that's over here. That's because my mind isn't linear. My mind is kind of, I want to add this to the presentation. I want to add that. I think this is a good idea. I think I want to do this. I read this. Here's the research. Like putting that all out and then eventually laying all this out and then combining cards, that helps. Like that helps so much. Like I think we get caught up, you know. I was really upset, and I tell this story all the time, that when my first grade, my son, he's in middle school now, but when he was in first grade, he was super amped because he made a keynote presentation, and it wasn't about me. And I was bummed because he's in first grade, man. He didn't really know how to tell a story from start to finish just yet. But yet, you know, we were excited that, or not we, but they were excited that they were teaching kids how to use Keynote. I'm like, well, what good is Keynote if he can't tell a story? You know, so it's like, so when I would work with him, and I still do it now, he's again, sixth grade, we were doing he had to do a TED talk, a TED talk style thing. And we did note cards, man. We drew them all out. We wrote them all out. What do you know? What do you think? He was about Roblox. Are you familiar with Roblox? It's a video game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So we were doing
My daughter's same age. Yeah.
So we're playing it all out.
So absolutely like that.
Oh my gosh. Like that's their world. And so we planned all this stuff out, and then we kind of sorted the note cards and moved them around and put them here and put them there and threw some away. And like before we ever opened up, you know, Keynote. And again, that's visual thinking. That's organizing those. It's not always necessarily just drawing pictures. It's also organizing my thinking in a way that makes sense, that I'm telling a story. You know, I have a picture I show of in one of my presentations of students using mind maps to plan out a video, yet we're going to grade them on a video.
Yeah.
It's, well, if you're not going to teach video production, why are you asking them to make a video? Like, why don't we teach them how to like tell a story, like that piece? I don't know. I'm kind of going on tangents, but
it's completely. When I used to teach journalism, and it was like I would have them use sticky notes on the wall, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they would storyboard everything from a 6-minute interview they were doing to an actual documentary, right? Like and sticky note storyboarding is how we did it, and everything was sketched with stick figures, right? But it might be, they might be, you know, sketching where the camera, you know, some kids are focusing on where the camera is and the staging in that side. And then other kids are focusing more on just storyboarding the ideas and where they want to take it. And, you know, other kids are not even doing that. They're going to the whiteboard. And again, this is why it's important that whiteboards become communal space, right? Mm-hmm. I learned the hard way, by the way, with that they will assume a whiteboard is the teacher's unless you explicitly give it to them. Like I had students do a map of the classroom and color in every part that they thought belonged to them personally, to the classroom as a whole, or to the teacher. And the space by the whiteboards were teacher space. And I was like, all right, we got to change this. But, you know, now after I got past that, they began just going straight to the board and sketching what they need. And some of them are sketching out flow charts. And again, it was this reminder that it's every kid has different ways of doing it,
mm-hmm.
right? But in the end, everybody did that first in the planning process or the ideation process before they ever did an outline or a project plan or anything like that, right? It was always something was sketched out first and every single time. And I was reminded of, you know, I saw a teacher who did something similar with project management, where she said, I want my students to learn how to manage a project. Her students were, I think, third graders, maybe second graders. And they went through the overarching idea of the project. They put it a calendar on butcher paper, and then they drew out all of their tasks on sticky notes. And then they stuck the sticky notes inside of the calendar days. And then every day they would show up, they would look at, you know, their sticky note. They would say, this is what I'm going to do today. Nice. They'd take it with them. And then at the end, and the key thing there was what she was teaching them how to do is think visually about time. Mm-hmm. And all of her students were on IEPs connecting to executive function. And so that was a huge part of executive function. And it just gave me this reminder of like, oh, when you engage in visual thinking, invisible thinking, and however you want to phrase it, it's so much bigger than learning how to draw, right? It's about executive function and metacognition and planning and organizing and curating and all of these other things.
It's so true. We kind of played around a little bit. Myself and Sadie Lewis, who we do a lot of design thinking workshops here, we started to play around with that project management. Like, time is very abstract to adults too. Mm-hmm. But trying to organize, very similar to what you were doing with sticky notes, like trying to organize time and understanding over a period of time how much things can happen. We're really good at making bulleted lists for kids. Like, okay, by Wednesday, you need to do this. But they don't understand how to chunk that into time, like how to put that into time so they can accomplish that on, you know, in Wednesday and Thursday do this. And maybe some of Wednesday is going to also go into Friday, like Wednesday to Friday, we're going to also have this. Like chunking that information and kind of creating a visual of elapsed time. That's really funny that we said that. We played around with it a little bit, more so with our high school students. But yeah, that's, you know, think about our calendars as grown adults. How many of us use our whatever calendar, and it's color-coded for the day, and it's color-coded for the week, and it's color-coded for the month? That's a visual for us. That's like, okay, I know, like, you know, the practices and the events and the whatevers and the, you know, that's.
And I'll tell you what, like, I love the calendar for what it is, and I use the digital calendar. I'm all about Google Calendar, but I'm telling you, if there was the option to even have iconography added to it, I mm-hmm. absolutely would.
Absolutely.
Know? And absolutely. I've thought about that. I've even thought, like, will it translate? You know, I've thought about taking it and even just using you know, the emojis and coding it and be like, this is, you know, an interview. This is a podcast interview. This is a, you know, and I'm sure people have done that before, because I want to be able to think visually with my calendar. And I do, the only thing I miss about that desktop calendar is mm-hmm. I would sketch everything out, you know?
You know, I started to use, I did it more so in my Google Drive, but now I'm going to try it with my calendar, because I have like the Mac with the little bar across the top. You can now type emojis. Like when you type, it brings up the emojis on that bar, and now I can type emojis on there, but that's going away apparently. But yeah, like I started doing that with my Google Drive, because my Google Drive is, no matter how many, like I color code, you only have so many colors, you know? And so like started to put emojis on my folders so that I can like, oh, okay, that's for this, and this. I need to try that for calendar. That's a great idea. I didn't even think about that.
No, I'm going to do that. I'm sure people have done it before.
Oh, for sure.
That's one of those moments where you're like, you know what? I'm sure someone's done it before, and I'm sure that the someone who's done it before is named Tony Vincent.
Right.
I know him at all, but I'm like, I bet Tony's done that before.
For sure. Yeah, like that bar across the top has helped, because now like it's easier to type emojis. Like I don't have to open up another keyboard. I don't have to copy paste anywhere.
Oh, that's really nice.
It's just there.
Very cool. Well, I do appreciate our time together and just how much you have shared about this idea of visible thinking. For people who are new to you and don't know your work, tell us a little bit about your website, your book.
Sure.
Just a few things where people can find you.
Yeah. So you can find me kind of on all on Twitter, Instagram, and at Manuel Herrera 33. I would definitely, you know, kind of go to Instagram because I am very visual. So I like to post a lot of things there. With the exception of this year, I like to post a lot of what kids do and a lot of their work. But since I haven't been in a classroom because of COVID, my website is manualdraws.com. You can see kind of some of the stuff that I do there. There's some resources that I have available if you want to take a look at any of those. Reach out to me. I'd be more than happy to chat with you, even chat with your kids. You know, I'm doing a drawing lesson next week with a fifth grade classroom just to get comfortable with, you know, drawing and just putting a pencil to paper, because they're going to be doing story maps and the teacher's like, they're all reluctant to draw. And so, I did illustrate my first book. It's called Aggie and the Thought Compass, which was super, just like, you know, childhood dream to be able to do. I am actually the illustrator, and Betsy O'Neill Sheehan is the author of the book, and I'm working on a second one, so I'm excited about that. So yeah, that's kind of where you can find me.
Yeah, very cool. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time, and thank you.
Yeah, no problem, man. Thanks.
All right, well, there you have it. That is Manuel Herrera sharing his ideas on how to make visual thinking a reality in your classroom. Would you do me a favor, if you enjoy this podcast, would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcast? Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day, and go out and make something awesome.